Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger or disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm your host, John McCoy, and with me is returning co-host Phil Gonzalez.
Hello, everybody. I'm Phil Gonzalez.
You know, Phil, it seems like we were just talking about something else.
Yeah. If you don't listen to Click It Cast, which is the podcast John and I had been doing for, what was it, like 7 years, 8 years, covering about 15 books?
Since the 1960s, I think.
We just got through doing our second final episode because of the passing of Beverly Cleary. But it got us into talking about books again and literature again and sort of era-specific literature, which is very much what Our Town is. We're talking about Our Town, right?
This was a topic that we decided on before the passing of Cleary. So it's an odd bit of synchronicity that this we are dealing with a play that deals so closely with mortality.
Yes. And Americana.
We are doing Our Town, which is Thornton Wilder's 1938 play, and the play for which he is best remembered. Although, here's my weird little anecdote. This is the last thing I think about when I think about Thornton Wilder, because I was not aware of Thornton Wilder as a writer until I saw a production of The Skin of Our Teeth that aired on PBS in the 1980s. I fell in love with that play. I bought a copy of the three plays, which is the standard Penguin edition that has Thornton Wilder's most famous plays in it. And I read The Skin of Our Teeth again and again. And then I read The Matchmaker, which is the basis for Hello, Dolly, if you aren't aware. And I was kind of amused by that because I loved the musical Hello, Dolly. And I did not read Our Town until I was flying on my AFS exchange year to Israel, and I had packed, for some reason, amongst the various books I had for my flight, I had packed my three-play volume of Thornton Wilder. And I read through Our Town, and I found it very, very sad and moody, and I loved it. I had no idea that this was the major work of theater that it is until much later.
That is wild. That it, to me, like, Our Town is like, it's stock. It was stock the year he released it. Like, I think, like, the year it became available for rights, there was like 800 productions worldwide. Like, it was immediately the most common play produced in the American theater.
When was the first time you remember interacting with this play, either as a viewer, a performer, or a reader?
Junior high. I believe we did it my seventh grade year in junior high. I remember because Jenny, who was an eighth grader, played Sally. Sally? Wait. Am I right? No. I'm forgetting Emily? All the characters' names all of a sudden.
Are you thinking Emily?
Emily. I was just looking at Cabaret. And I was like, wait, that's the wrong play. I had this whole I am a camera thing going on in other tabs. No, but yes, played Emily. And then I want to say that's what happened. Either that or this is Phil's memory. We either did it in junior high or she was already in high school and they did it in the high school, but they used kids from the junior high in it. Maybe she was in the high school production as a little kid for like the graveyard scene. There was this tie there, so we all read Our Town. It was like, because Jenny is in Our Town, let's all read Our Town. And we were like, okay. And then we were like, we don't get it. And then I read it later on in high school, and I was like, But by the time I got to high school, I was like, I'm too cool for this. This is like podunk theater. I'm interested in like the future of theater, not these plays about towns and milkmen and mortality. And it wasn't until I got older that I went back and reread it, and it just clicked and it made sense. And then I got the Thornton Wilder biography and read about the writing of Our Town and like his life leading up to that and his life after that, and was like, this is an amazing play.
For such a popular play, it's a very plotless play.
Mm-hmm.
It is a play about the small fictional town of Grover's Corners, New Hampshire, and literally people walk on the stage and talk a little bit about life in the city to the audience in a declamatory way. They talk about the geology of New Hampshire. They talk about the modern conveniences of cars and other technology, and they talk about astronomy. And in the midst of this, there are two families, the Gibbs and the Webbs, who have two offspring, George and Emily, who eventually marry, and then one of them dies, and that's basically the plot.
For what it is, yeah. And in the midst of all that, at unexpected moments, characters will suddenly turn to the audience and have existential crises, emotional breakdowns, and then the stage manager will usher them back off the set, and it's like, that's enough of that. Let's get back to the wedding. And and you're left there holding the script in your hands going, oh my God, I can't believe he got away with this. And that people just weren't, there weren't riots in the theaters, because he says stuff in this play that is stuff that is shocking to hear today. Like if a character in a TV drama today who was about to get married, whose daughter was about to get married, turned to the screen and was like, I hate marriage. It's so unfair to the woman. It is so unfair. This is the worst thing you can do to a girl. She's not like, you'd be like, oh, wow, this is intense. And the fact that he did this in the late 30s was just, it was stunning. And audiences were stunned. They didn't know how to respond to it.
It was, for its time, an extremely experimental play, but it doesn't feel experimental. This is one of the paradoxes of being a writer of plain style, homespun literature. You know, I've felt this before. I don't know why Wilder isn't more held in the center of American modernism than he is. I think he has a certain place in the world of theater, which is this play. But if you take a course in American modernism, you will probably start with Gertrude Stein, and then you will go through Hemingway and Faulkner and Fitzgerald, and then you're kind of done.
Yeah. Which is, but it's important to note, though, that Wilder was not only a contemporary of Gertrude Stein and Ernest Hemingway, he was like best friends with them. And his job was to be Gertrude Stein's, not her editor, but he would read all of her work and then write her letters back and be like, I have no idea what you're talking about in this. You need to fix it. Like you're Gertrude Steining all over the place, Gertrude. You need to become or I'll write you an introduction and an epilogue to your book of ideas that will explain to the audience what they are about to read, just so you're not completely lost in the reads. And I'll get Alexander Wolcott to make sure it gets printed.
This play comes out just like a decade and a half after, what, Six Characters in Search of an Author, which
yeah.
is kind of the watershed moment in theater for, okay, now we're going to, anything goes, characters will jump in and out of character, sometimes they will be themselves, sometimes they will be the actor portraying themselves, there will be all these hand-waving to the audience to say, look, you're watching a play,
mm-hmm.
this is a play. And there's a lot in this play about how theater works.
Yeah.
A lot of little jokes. You know, there's a point where this is a play that famously has almost no scenery, no set, and that might be one of the reasons why it's so popular to put on. You don't actually have to construct a set, but there's a point where they move a trellis out in the background, and he says, "There's scenery for people who think we need to have scenery."
This was all deliberate on his part because he didn't want anything to distract from what the characters were saying, what the play was trying to do. This wasn't meant to be spectacle. And the humor that he put into the play, any humor that's in Our Town was the result of him not cutting it, because he pared the script down to its barest bones in order to make it what it is. And he actually fought Jed Harris, the original director, who was a theatrical tyrant, who was good friends with Orson Wilder, but their friendship dissolved over the direction of Our Town, kept trying to put jokes in. Orson Wilder would go into rehearsals and there would be jokes added to the script, and he would be furious because he's like, "No, the script is perfect. You don't change it." And if you look at his, Wilder wrote a bunch of notes for later productions. That was basically like, "Here's what not to do in Our Town." And you realize from reading his notes why the play is done so much and why it's done poorly so often. Because producing this play, I think we talked about this with Skin of Our Teeth, which is that a play isn't a book. It's not meant to just be read. It lives on stage. The actors have to imbue it with life. The director has to imbue it with direction. The set, the design, it's all part of a whole. And Our Town, can it be pretty flat on the page? And getting it on stage in a watchable format, in an emotionally affecting format, is massively difficult. Because it can become maudlin. It can become, as Wilder says, lugubrious. That third act can be deadly for an audience if it's not done at the exact right pace, with the exact right approach, with the exact right intention. But it's deceptively simple. It's like the Fantastics. Like, "Oh, there's no set. There's only a few cast members. Great, we can do this." And then it's three acts long, and you're sitting in the theater for a long time.
I think it's absolutely telling what you say about the stage directions in this play are minimal, but they typically are Wilder admonishing people not to do something that he thinks could be a trap. You know, he talks about in the third scene, there are people who are dead who are on the stage, and they have to sit still. They are ostensibly there at their graves or in their graves or in some other spatial place relating to the action as it takes place on the stage. And he's warning them, you know, don't try to be sonorous about this. Don't try to, you know, be maudlin about this. You are not sentimental, but you're not like going to put on a spooky ghost voice.
He would drop in on performances, you know, after the runs had started, and he would always say that third act would suddenly be like twice as long, and the actors would basically just be sort of doing their because they would, and he'd be like, "No, like these are the characters, like it's not that they're ghosts, it's just that they don't care about the living anymore. They have moved beyond that." It's such a fine balance, and I've seen high school productions of Our Town, and I've seen that balance tip in the wrong direction.
Right. I mean, the other thing that's interesting about the stage directions for me is at this time in the 30s and stuff, there were lots of really ridiculously long stage directions. I've mentioned before my all-time favorite stage direction comes from William Saroyan's The Time of Our Life, where at the very beginning of the play, a character walks into a soda fountain place, and there's a pinball machine, and Saroyan spends a page and a half discussing what the symbolic meaning is of this character playing pinball. And he says, like, it's American optimism against the futility of industrialism. And I'm like, and you're like, what the hell does that mean for an actor? And, you know, and he's spent so long writing this, and it's not going to come out anywhere except when you read it.
Right.
And it's telling that a lot of playwrights at the time were writing with an eye towards being literature. Mm-hmm. Certainly Arthur Miller did that. He, you know, I just did The Crucible, and The Crucible has long digressions that aren't part of the play. They're
right.
just Arthur Miller talking about the action of the play and talking about the what really happened to the characters that are being fictionalized in this play.
Well, that's why it's important to delineate, if people aren't familiar with plays, the way they're published is you have acting editions of plays and you have reading editions of plays. And when you produce a play, a lot of times you get the acting edition, which has frequently minimal stage directions. When you get the reading edition of the play, that's when you're going to get these long digressions that the first, if you're acting off one of those, the first thing the director says is just cross all that out, cross it out. This has nothing to do with the play we're doing. But Wilder, of course, was a novelist and a short fiction writer. And Our Town was the moment where he was like, this is my future. I know what I'm doing now. He was notorious for being very, like, he didn't have a lot of confidence about his abilities when his previous stuff had been produced. He had let the directors kind of run roughshod over it. But it's funny to read about him writing this. He's communicating with Gertrude Stein, and he's communicating with his sisters, and he's saying, I'm writing this play called, originally it was called M. Mary Zen, then it was called Our Village. But he's like, I'm writing this play. Not only is this the greatest thing I've ever written, I think this is the best play ever written. And he just kept saying that. He was like, no, this is going to be really good. And everyone was like, I can't believe that Thornton's like really excited about this play he's writing. But what's awesome is that while he was writing this, he was also working on The Matchmaker, the play that would eventually become The Matchmaker. It was called The Merchant of Yonkers at the time. And as he was writing Our Town, he was also getting ideas in his head for The Skin of Our Teeth. He was like, okay, I'm going to use bits of this play, like ideas I'm coming up with this, to write an even bigger play about America and about the American drama and about life in America. And I'm not going to look back. He hated looking back at his previous work. But he did look back a lot at Our Town, I feel. Like, he wrote a lot about it. And he wrote forwards to his new, I don't know. There was something about Our Town was, Wilder would still be Wilder if he hadn't written Our Town, but his position in American letters wouldn't be where it is. I mean, he won the Pulitzer for it, and he's still the only person to win the Pulitzer for novel and playwriting. Like that record still stands. Like, it was a big deal.
It occurs to me that as we talk about this, that we're getting deep into like theater stories, which is a fun thing to do. If you especially if you've ever spent a lot of time in theater, people like to talk about productions a lot.
Oh, do they?
And Phil very kindly got me for my birthday this year the book Another Day's Begun, which is a critical analysis of productions of Our Town, and it starts with a bit of a historical discussion of the original conception, writing, and staging of Our Town, and then it is about 200 pages of actors and directors talking about productions that they've been in Our Town, and it's fascinating for me. I think that for people who aren't necessarily involved in the theater, they would wonder what on earth this thing is.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the way actors and directors are. They like to sit there and Sunday morning quarterback productions that they saw, you know, back. People have very strong memories of a production that they saw of Our Town in 1962 or
yep.
something like that. Yeah.
For those of people who haven't read Our Town, all the action, like John mentioned, is sort of guided by this character called the stage manager. And this wasn't the first time Wilder had had a stage manager character in one of his plays, who guided people through. But this is the first time he'd written a three-act play that broke the reality and was like, you're seeing a play, and it's about our town. It's about Grover's Corners. And Wilder said that what he wanted to do is he wanted to write a play. Basically, he wanted a play that simultaneously explored humankind's insignificance in the face of, like, the universe. The fact that we live and we die, and it's just an endless cycle. It just, we live and we die, and we live and we die, and then we're dead and we're gone. And ultimately, the dead don't care about the living, and ultimately our lives aren't that important. But at the same time, also say, there is nothing more important in this world than the minutiae of everyday life. And every single person is as important as the distant star. Like, to say, to keep in balance this idea that we are utterly insignificant, but also there is nothing more important than the life of every human being on this planet, is this wonderful tightrope that this play walks. And to also, like, have the characters' emotional lives be born out of this, and to have all the characters constantly be aware that they are insignificant, but also that everything is very important. Like, you can have a moment in the play just about them eating breakfast, and you're like, this is mundane. This has never been shown on the stage before, but also show the audience, this is important, and you should be paying attention to this. You can't have when Emily goes back to the you know, an insignificant day in her life, and she realizes that there are no insignificant days in your life. You can't look at an insignificant day in your life, because if you look at it hard enough, you realize how important everything was, how important every moment in your life was, and that we'll never realize that, and that's our tragedy. And we can't realize that in order to get through life, because those moments when you realize how important life is when you freak out at your own wedding because you're not ready for life to be that big. I don't know. And Wilder does it with this lyricism and this grace that can easily tip over into cornpone advice, into, like, aw, shucks, small townism. But if you play it right, becomes this sort of, like, fluid, almost like orchestral movement from one beat to the next. It just flows until all of a sudden you realize you're watching a play about death, and that you're left with this sense of, like, I am a beautiful person. My life is important, but also utterly insignificant. I don't know. All I know is that Eleanor Roosevelt saw it, and she said that she was glad she saw it, but that it didn't leave her happy in the end.
It is a play that is heavy on ideas, mm-hmm. and to the extent that the characters are characters, they are shown as character types. They're shown as these are typical people having typical lives, and the very mundane nature of everything that's happening is the point.
Right.
And it's ironic because Emily's monologue at the end, it's not that long. It's a kind of a short monologue about her realization of the importance of every moment of life, is one of those speeches that gets used all the time as an audition piece. It's like in almost every audition book you get for, like, young woman actors, you know, like they'll have like 100 audition pieces, and one of them's going to be Emily's speech from the third act of Our Town.
I can't go on. It goes so fast. We don't have time to look at one another. I didn't realize. So all that was going on, and we never noticed. Take me back up the hill to my grave. But first, wait. One more look. Goodbye. Goodbye, world. Goodbye, Grover's Corners. Mama and Papa. Goodbye to clocks ticking and Mama's sunflowers and food and coffee and new iron dresses and hot baths and sleeping and waking up. Oh, Earth, you're too wonderful for anybody to realize you. Do any human beings ever realize life while they live it? Every minute?
No. The saints and poets, maybe. They do some.
I'm ready to go back.
It's an ideas speech. You know, it's not a speech that gives the actor a lot of beats for character development.
No.
And a lot of the characters, the thing that's funny about this play is the characters aren't really distinct characters except when they break character.
Right.
Then they get to be distinct characters. And that was also the case in The Skin of Our Teeth, where in The Skin of Our Teeth, it was much more, developed this idea of, when I'm a character on stage, I'm an allegory. When I'm the actor playing that character, breaking character, you get to be a person. But it's so in some ways, it's a hard play to act, I would imagine, in that you don't get a lot of choices as an actor.
It's the fact that so many high schools do it is obvious why, because you have these young leads, you have four young characters who are, you know, two of them whom are central to the action and the other two are present in a huge chunk of the first act, at least. And you have to have solid actors to play those roles. So I can see why high schools do it, and a lot of regional theaters and community theaters do it. But you're right, because this isn't easy for actors to find that those two, three levels of remove from the characters that are constantly shifting, to play something, to play a scene realistically and as, you know, as the Meisner technique teaches you to play it, and then to suddenly be stopped in the middle of your scene and to have to pull back a level and suddenly be the actor playing that character, or suddenly have to shift characters because, you know, the script calls for you to be man in audience or to be the man in the audience who comes up and talks about the town's geological bedrock and not bore the audience, but not entertain the audience, because the part of the joke is that he is very dry and flat and just kind of like, I'm just here to talk about that. I don't know why I'm really here. Also having the audience being aware that they're all going to be wondering, what am I watching? Why is this happening? And to be, I don't know, there are so many layers that if you lose one of them, you're going to lose the audience. And yeah, it's a difficult play.
When I was young and I would hang out at my local library, there was this book that I checked out once that fascinated me. It was called something like Five Allegorical Plays for All Female Casts.
That does sound like a book that would have fascinated you when you were a child.
And it was, I think it dated back to the 1930s. And as I've grown older, I understand that this is a book that is written of short plays for amateur theater groups to put on. You know, there would be like an you remember in the Music Man, there was the mayor's wife had that society for aesthetics that put on the living tableaus.
Yeah.
and such. They were not good plays,
right.
but they were all highly allegorical, and they all had to do with like knights and chivalry and allegories of love and truth and what have you. And I think that this is part of the world that that Wilder is coming out of here, is this world in which people were very familiar with highly allegorical plays. I mean, there were the symbolists of the 19th century, and I think that kind of worked its way into a kind of mainstream understanding of what that was. And so in some ways, Wilder wrote allegories that blew apart the whole idea of allegory.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know much more to say than that is, today, I think maybe we're a little bit more used to characters breaking the fourth wall. We're a little bit more used to lines from actors that make reference to the actor's own lives or to contemporary events or whatever. So maybe that doesn't shock us as much.
Right.
But it is funny that such an experimental play, again, became so... So produced by local theater groups, and it also, you mentioned the Fantastics. I don't think the Fantastics could exist without this play. Mm-hmm. I think in some ways, reading it through this time, I was actually like, oh, this is where they got that idea, or this is where, you know, there's a lot of stuff that seems highly cribbed out of this out of Our Town into the Fantastics. And in some ways, the Fantastics is a sort of a step back into a more sentimentalized vision.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the Fantastics is a step back into a more cynical vision, because the Fantastics does get so dark.
But it gets dark in the way that 1960s drama, you know, are dark. You know, I think that it also is the same era of Man of La Mancha or Murat Saad. You're going to deal with these very dark aspects of human personality, but you're going to ultimately affirm something of the, you know, the triumph of the human spirit in the midst of this.
Well, I think that's Broadway in general, modern American musicals, not plays so much, but your musical will toe the line and dabble in the dark side of human nature, but rarely leave you feeling anything less than it's all going to be okay.
And you're thinking of Les Misérables here.
Yeah, or, you know, like even like, you know, you're, no matter what they say, they're going to reassure the audience that you're good, and don't worry, you're good. You know, your Sweeney Todds are rare, but what I like about Our Town is that, you know, this Broadway audience, I guess it opened in, what is it, Boston? I think it originally premiered, it previewed in Boston, maybe went to New Haven, but it, early audiences were like mixed. Some of them were like, this is amazing, and some of them were like, well, I don't know, this is a mess. And then it opens on Broadway, and critics were like, either this is great or this is a mess. But it was intriguing enough that audiences flocked to go see it, and it was a huge hit. But this was, I think he also had a production, he'd done a translation of A Doll's House that was on Broadway at the same time. So Wilder was no slouch. He was no, like, he wasn't unfamiliar with success, but, you know, this, I think it may have surprised him how much people kind of clung to this play and were, like, attached to this play. I think it speaks to something that we're all afraid to say or afraid to think about. We're all afraid to think about death, and we're all afraid to think about, like, the fleetingness of human existence. But also, it kind of plays on that fear of thinking that our small lives are important as well. Like, it's scary to think that we have significance as well. There's a existential crisis in that, of being like, I'm not, it's sometimes easier to think my little life isn't that big a deal, and to have a playwright go, no, little lives are a big deal. It's important that you are here. That's just as scary as thinking that the dead don't care about us.
Also, the difficult thing to balance in this play that Wilder does balance is he's dealing with a tiny, tiny New England town, mm-hmm. which is just a cliche of Americana, yeah. the small New England town, and the stage manager adopts the Pepperidge Farm voice throughout a lot of this, and there's a lot of like, oh, you can hear the train coming down the hill right now, and he acknowledges that this is a legitimate way of living, and he acknowledges that there is value and dignity in this way of life, even as characters, as they do, wonder about the world outside of Grover's Corners, mm-hmm. and some leave and some come back. It's neither going to be too celebratory of this small town life, nor is it going to be too critical of it.
And that first act, you know, you mentioned like, oh, there's the train coming around the bend, and over there's this church, and over there's this church, and you're like, okay, like this is cute. Yeah, Pepperidge Farm does remember. But then you get that first gut punch where the paper boy shows up, and he's talking about, I can't find the kid's name. What is it? Who is the paper boy? It is Joe Crowell. And he says, you know, Joe Crowell comes in, and you have this great scene where he's talking to Dr. Gibbs, and he's like, you know, like, my teacher's getting married. And Dr. Gibbs is like, well, I declare, how do you feel about that? And he have this like little exchange. He's like, how's your knee, Joe? And he's like, it's just fine, sir. He's like, gonna rain today? He's like, no, sir. You sure? Yes, sir. And you're like, this is cute. And then the stage manager stops this action. He's like, Joe Crowell, really bright. He graduated from, ends up graduating from high school. He's the head of his class. He gets a scholarship to Massachusetts Tech, graduates head of his class there too. He was going to be a great engineer, but then war broke out and he died in France. And you're like, as an audience, it's like, oh no, we're doing that now. And then later on, he's like, so the first act of this play is about, you know, life. The second act's about marriage, and you could probably figure out what that third act's going to be about. And then he goes on, and you're like, or at least I was when I reread it the other day, I was like, oh no. Like, he knows what he's doing. Like, Wilder knows what he's playing with, the expectation so much. Now you have this dread in the pit of your stomach. He's already thrown a curveball at you. Second act is going to present the wedding, and then it's going to get unsettling, and then you know that third act is just going to pull off the Band-Aid. And I think there's this dark brilliance, this sense of almost Hitchcockian like anticipation of like, what is this third act going to be? Who's going to die? Like, what's it going to be about? And then you find out, in a way very similar to Hamlet, when the funeral procession is starting and Hamlet's not aware who's dead until the body gets brought out, that it's your heroine. It's your main character. It's the focus of this optimistic character who is like, I'm going to go on, I'm going to give speeches, and I'm going to be somebody. And you're untethered as an audience. This play isn't going the way a small town play is supposed to go. And then you have the stage manager constantly saying, no, this is life. I'm just showing you Grover's Corners. This isn't good or bad. You want to see a play about a small town? Well, this is what happens in a small town. People live and they die, and the town moves on. And sometimes you get a hospital wing named after you because you were the town doctor. And sometimes you just get buried up on the hill and your relations forget that you died a few years ago. That's just life. And it's not that it's not important. It's just that's life. And then it goes on and more babies are born down in Polish town. Like, and I love that. That's my taste. I got to a certain age and literature, I said years ago, I said, you live long enough, all literature becomes horror literature, because you realize that these characters are all going to die one day. And to me, like, that's any book I read, if I'm in the right mindset, I'm like, oh, this is a horror novel, because they don't know that death is coming.
You see, I had the sort of the opposite happen to me as a reader, which is I for a long time I wouldn't read horror, and then I started to read it, and I thought, you know, this Stephen King is just a big softie.
Yep.
He's like, in some ways, it's kind of embarrassing how sentimental sometimes Stephen King gets. Like, I mean, he'll dismember his characters, but he's also going to talk about how much they love each other mm-hmm. and you know how much friendship means to these characters and how this one act of kindness changed their lives.
I would go so far as to say that King actually, well, A, besides being a New Englander, he owes a large debt to Wilder because he knows that there is value in exploring the minutia of a character's life, no matter how unimportant they are to a story. He'll spend a chapter giving you the backstory of a character who literally dies in the next sentence, just so you go, oh, this person was important in their own way, even if they never realized it. They were important. Like, to me, that's Wilder. That's what Wilder is doing. So
I was just reading Stephen King's On Writing, mm-hmm. and he mentions early on like an influence of Sherwood Anderson. And Sherwood Anderson's Winesburg, Ohio, is another precursor to this kind of story of a town, of a community coming together and interlocking stories. It's a lot... Anderson is a lot gloomier, and his characters are a lot wackier. Mm-hmm. In some ways, the characters in this, again, are so normal and so little unexpected happens to them, and they make so few unexpected choices. The other thing that this reminds me of is Dylan Thomas's Under Milkwood. It opens with the dawn of a new day and with a... In Dylan Thomas's case, two narrators, not just one narrator, explaining what's happening in this town and what this town means. But by the time the characters show up, they're also a lot wackier
yeah.
and a lot more characters.
Well, Wilder also said later on, like a decade or so after this, produced that he the third act is almost a reaction to or a refutation of Spoon River Anthology. And he calls it out. He's like, this isn't Spoon River. These characters aren't going to tell you their lives. He may have, actually, this may have been when he was writing about the writing of the play. I can't remember what but he calls out Spoon River, not critically, but to say, like, I deny the idea that the dead would want you to know about their life. The dead don't care about their lives anymore. And so what you're seeing on this hill isn't Spoon River's cemetery. It's a real cemetery of the dead, which is people who, when you remind them of their lives, are like, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I did do that, huh? Well, anyway, and... He thought there was more power in that. There was more truth in that than what Spoon River does, which is have the dead tell you their stories.
Yeah, that's all the Spoon River anthology is a bunch of dead people telling their stories. I mentioned Dylan Thomas. In Under Milkwood, there's a sequence in which, what's his name, Captain Cat is remembering his lost love. What was her name? What was her name? I'll have to do a podcast on Under Milkwood sometime. But there's a sequence where this dead woman appears in a dream, and she also talks about how the dead forget things slowly. That's the process of death, is forgetting until the final line is I've forgotten that I was ever born. Which seems like a very chilling moment, but then the character shows up at the very end of the play and says, I've forgotten dying now.
Mm.
And that seems to be the sort of apotheosis that takes her out of this liminal space between this world and the next. And that seems to be what Wilder is pointing at with his characters here, too, is that they're waiting around until the point that they stop being connected to this world.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's not seen as a tragedy, and it's not seen as like the Greek afterlife where like everyone just sort of becomes this mindless mob of personalityless. So, like they have personality, they have a community. Like it's still part of the town. It's just they're not concerned about the town anymore. They're not concerned, but they also understand the importance of life. It's really weird, but it makes sense in the context. And you have. In the second act, the wedding is you have this notion that you keep getting told by the stage manager and other characters that human beings are meant to be paired off, that no one is meant to be alone. But then you have the character Stimson, who is it? The organist, the church organist, who is clearly alone and is an alcoholic and had quote unquote troubles in his life. You never find out what those troubles were. Who ends up taking his own life, as you find out in Act 3. But you have this wedding, which is set up to be this huge celebration and ends up becoming this repeated trauma for the women in the play. And even to an extent to George, who's getting married, that they don't actually come out and say it, but there's this heightened anxiety about the wedding night. The fact that you didn't talk to girls about sex, that was not something that you did. And so this young girl is going to go into her wedding night not knowing what to do, and there's a heightened expectation there. The fact that the wedding is seen as more of a tragedy, is treated like the tragedy, whereas the death is treated as just a part of living. I don't know, there's a contradiction there that he plays out, but that is very unsettling and very dark in the middle of the play.
The declamation that weddings are so unfair to women, it reminds me of, there's a sequence in The Skin of Our Teeth in the second act. The second act of Skin of Our Teeth is always the weakest one to me. It's the one that I have the hardest time sort of remembering the action of, but there is a sequence where Mrs. Antrobus throws a bottle into the ocean and says that she's written on it all the secrets that women know. And it makes me a little cringy as a modern reader, because it seems like a guy trying to give his female characters agency, but he's still doing it via the sort of this idea that women are an alien species that are ultimately unknowable to men. But you know, I feel like Wilder is trying to be progressive for his time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, he was best friends with Gertrude Stein. Like, he couldn't help but be a little progressive for his time.
Well, Gertrude Stein is progressive for our time.
Yes. What's funny is after the play had been running for a little while, Frank Craven, who came out of retirement to play the stage manager and whose son was also in the play, Frank Craven needed some time off, and so the director was like, "Thornton, I need you to step in and play the stage manager." And so Thornton Wilder played the stage manager in our town a few times over his life, usually in like little regional productions. And I can just imagine like being like, "Oh, there's a regional production of our town going on. Oh, Thornton Wilder's in it." But he said that was like the hardest thing. He sat down. He's like, "I guess I need to rehearse this play and learn these lines that I wrote," and suddenly realized how much he had given the stage manager to say. And he was like, oh no. So he ended up rehearsing it. Oh God, I wish I had it pulled up. He of course was like friends with every single, like, most talented person in the world. And he ended up having to do his own like personal rehearsal of Our Town. I don't have it pulled up, but a major director just helped him, like, before he brought it into the cast, he did a lot of rehearsing. And I think it's funny that, like, he wrote this incredibly difficult part without ever intending to have to do it himself. This part that, like, if I was cast as a stage manager, I would, like, be freaked out about having to memorize this whole thing and then ended up having it. That, to me, that's, like, a great comeuppance to any playwright, is having to play this difficult character.
Yeah, I would say the stage manager has at least half the lines in the play.
And Spalding Gray famously did a whole monologue about having to play the stage manager in Our Town. And just what a... He was Spalding Gray's cast because he is from New England, and they were like, "Oh, he can pull this off." But then you can see the Spalding Gray production. It's online. And you're like, "Oh, he's intense. Like, Spalding Gray's creepy." And he had a hard time, like, not just being Spalding Gray playing the stage manager of Our Town and they kept saying, like, "You have to be folksier, be warmer. You're scaring the audience," and him like having to find that like balance play. I think, was it in Monster in a Box, one of his big monologues, he talks about playing the stage manager in Our Town and just this like, wow, like what an intense, it also Spalding Gray was like 7 feet tall. So you have like the most intimidating man on stage coming out. I don't know. What a, like, Alana and I read the play out loud to each other when I was like brushing up on the story just 2 days ago, and she was like, "You really want to play this part, don't you?" And I was like, "Yeah, I want to play the stage manager one day, just like just sink my teeth into that role and have a good time playing it." So if any producers out there are listening and they want to and they want a scrawny guy in his 40s to play the stage manager one of these days, I'm down for it.
Now, how would you approach playing the stage manager? Because it feels to me like you can't necessarily approach him from the sort of the Stanislavskian sort of method of finding the motivation. The character, he seems kind of like an unmotivated character,
but he's not. Like he says in the script, he says repeatedly like why he's doing this, and it's because he's basically writing this play as we go along. He's assembling this story because he thinks it's important to leave this play so that future – he gets like all science fiction-y. He's like, future archaeologists need a work of fiction to tell them what life was like at this point in America. Like, we know what all the kings and the emperors were doing because that's what people wrote about, but we only know a few things about the daily lives of the Greeks and the Romans from a few comedies we have scattered about. So it is very important that this play encapsulate everything, and that I, the stage manager, have to keep a tight rein on it because we only have three acts, and I have to encompass life, marriage, and death, but I've also got to get in a few things about the geography, a little bit about the history and culture. I've got to make sure everyone knows that I'm not making fun of these people, but I'm not glorifying these people. And you have to know that human life is important, but also small town life is insignificant, but also just as important as the city. Like, I'm the stage manager, but I'm not a neurotic. I have a plan. I've got to keep this story going, and I've got to keep these people in line, and I need you, the audience, to know that this is really important to me and really important to kind of the future of human life, and that it's not important that I'm a folksy New Englander, but I am a folksy New Englander, so we're just going to start from that and just sort of build on. I don't know. There is intention there. He's just gotta take this play and he's just gotta keep pulling it along for the benefit of the audience and keep you engaged and let you know that you're not seeing the Spoon River anthology. You're not seeing the Diviners or some like slice of New England Americana. You're seeing the most important play you will ever see in your life, and it's also gonna entertain you, and then you're gonna have to leave and sort of sit on it for a while. Oops. Looks like our play is about done. Have a good evening, y'all. Go enjoy the rest of your night. And everyone's just sitting there like, oh, no, what did I just witness? Oh, it's a play about life and death and just how amazing all that is. So, yeah, like you hope that you get that through in your production without like blowing everyone's mind too much and also not boring everyone to death at the same time.
I have two things I want to end with. First of all, I want to say the Captain Katz lover, dead lover, was Rosie Probert, and I will go back and edit that in, so it seems like I knew what I was saying all along. Secondly, Grover's Corners is not a real place, but he does make mention of a lot of real places in New Hampshire. Mm. Quite often, he talks about people going to North Conway, and as a New Englander myself, I want to say. I this really warmed my heart because North Conway in the White Mountains is this sort of a resort town where people go to hang out, to camp. And North Conway also has, I don't know why I feel compelled to mention this, but North Conway has a theme park in it called Storyland, which is a theme park for little kids. And I think it dates back to like 1920 or something, and it still has a lot of its original attractions, which consist of large fiberglass statues of Humpty Dumpty, that your kid can sit by and get their picture taken with.
Yeah, or that makes sense.
The Three Little Pigs or whatever, or the Crooked Man's Crooked House. I cannot recommend this enough if you are ever in North Conway. Talk about an encapsulation of a time. It really has not changed much. There are a few new rides there. They're all on one side of the park. Forget those new rides. Go to the stuff that nightmares are made of, and see Storyland if you're in North Conway.
I thought you were going to say there's an Our Town section. Like,
oh, there should be.
Ride the George and Emily coaster. It always ends at death. There was something I had to look up in the play when we were reading it, where he says, all males vote at the age of 21, women vote indirect. And I was like, I don't know what that means. Like, what does it mean to vote indirect? And that is where you don't vote for the people in office. You're voting for the people who elect the people in office. And I don't quite get how it worked. But, like, women had a different voting system in Grover's Corners than the men did. Obviously, this is, you know, early days of I mean, this would be 1938, so, you know, like, I just don't understand. Like, I never understood, like, the politics of Grover's Corners. I don't understand New England politics. So, also, I did want to point out that I once upon a time attempted to write a play that combined Grover's Corners from Our Town with Grover's Mills from the Orson Welles version of War of the Worlds. I was like, what if Grover's Corners was part of Grover's Mills and there was an Our Town-esque play that told the story of the Martian invasion? I got about 3 pages in before I realized this was way beyond my abilities. But I think that idea still has credence. So somebody out there, Alan Moore or whoever, if you ever feel like tackling it, because I know Alan Moore, I know that Grover's Corners does exist in the series of Unfortunate Gentlemen or whatever it's called that he wrote. I can't remember the name of those comic books. League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, that's what it's called. I know that he did mention Grover's Corners, so, and Grover's Mill, so it's there. The possibility is there, Alan Moore.
Well, Grover's Mill is in New Jersey.
Oh, I know.
That's a completely different world.
In my fictional fantasy world, they can exist simultaneously. Same Grover.
You put some New Jerseyans and some New Englanders together, and it's going to be a recipe for trouble.
But good talk.
Yeah. What, any last thoughts before we close this down, before we tell them to smoke if they got them?
If you haven't read Our Town in a while, and you were like, oh, that's that dumb play about a little town, give it another look. It's worth rereading, and if you're me, sitting at your computer and sobbing all through Act 3, because that's what this play did to me when I reread it. Literally could not stop crying as wave upon wave of grief and nostalgia washed over me.
If that's not a recommendation, I don't know what is.
And then go read The Matchmaker, because you know what? That's a funny play.
Thanks again to co-host Phil Gonzalez. Phil has way too many podcasts, but here they are. Deep in Bear Country, a Berenstain Bears podcast. It's Del Toro Time, a podcast about Guillermo del Toro. Pizza Toast, a podcast about the Babysitter's Club. And the sadly just finished Click It Cast, in which Phil and I discuss the books and life of Beverly Cleary. The excerpt from the play was read by Shannon Camp and Zach Powers. If you haven't already, listen to Shannon's podcast, Little Women, a modern audio drama, which is an updated radio drama based upon Louisa May Alcott's novel. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. You can write the show at sophomore.literature@gmail.com, or you can join the discussion either on the Facebook page or the Incomparable membership Slack. I hope your spring term is going well, everybody. But whatever you do, be sure to keep up on the reading, because everything will be on the final.